You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, legal scholar Jedediah Purdy joins us to walk us through what it means to look at a landscape and see the shared and imposed meaning within it. First, the average age of a farmer in Wisconsin is 57 years old, a number that has continued to rise in the last 30 years. As Hope Kerwin reports, communities in rural Wisconsin are starting to worry how they'll be impacted as farmers continue to get older.
Casey Paff points out different buildings on his family's dairy farm in Jackson County.
Here's where all of our calves go right after they're born. Got our calf up there.
He's 27, and after graduating from college a few years ago, he came back to work with his parents. One day, Casey hopes to take over the dairy farm, just like his dad, Steve Paff, did in 1994. But Steve says passing on the farm to his son will be more complicated than it was 20 years ago.
For me, it's going to be at an older age than what it was for my dad. It's just the way times are.
Steve says profits in the last decade have not kept up with the increasing cost of equipment and other inputs, even in years when there are high commodity prices. And his wife, Kristen Paff, says more producers have turned to loans to cover their expenses. They're able to borrow more thanks to strong land values.
Banks are willing to lend farmers more money, which in turn makes it difficult for the next generation to buy farmers out because they maybe have more of a debt than they wish they had.
The Paffs are just starting to work toward a farm transition, so they have time to figure out their financial situation. But Steve says many of his farming neighbors in Jackson County aren't so lucky.
Even in our small area, you could take a 20-mile radius of our farm here. Of the kids that are wanting to take the family farm over or farm with their folks, it's fewer and fewer.
University of Wisconsin ag agent Tricia Wagner helps farmers in Jackson County plan for the future. She says if a farm doesn't have a successor, it makes the future more uncertain for the land and for the owners.
Many might be relying on selling their farm in order to fund aspects of their retirement or to supplement their retirement, which has a lot of consequences. You know, if they can't find someone to carry on the business, then, you know, what is the value of that farm?
Farming communities across Wisconsin are facing two problems. The baby boomer generation is now in their 60s, and there are fewer young people going into farming. In the last 20 years, the number of operators in Wisconsin between the ages of 25 and 34 has decreased by more than half. Wagner says it's become more difficult for young farmers to buy out current owners or start their own farm.
Land, facilities, machinery, not to mention livestock, all of that at once is, for many people, cost prohibitive. And, you know, some might say, well, it was always challenging, and I think that's probably true, but it's clear that many people feel like it is more challenging today.
If a farmer can't find someone to continue their operation, Wagner says they may sell their land to a larger farm or take it out of agriculture completely. One in eight jobs in Jackson County rely on the ag industry, so Wagner says losing farms is an unsettling possibility. Meanwhile, Kristen Paff says their family has already seen neighboring farms sell to larger operations.
They're getting bigger, and there's less and less of us smaller ones. Are we getting pushed out? No, I don't think we're getting pushed out. I think we just have different ideas on how we want to succeed.
That success means ensuring their son Casey can continue to milk cows on their family's farm without the pressure to expand or sell out. But for Steve Paff, success also means being able to support both generations until he's actually ready to stop farming. And Paff says he's not ready to think about retirement just yet. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. You can find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR.org/change. Joining us now to give us a preview of that series is WPR's news director, Noah Ovshinsky. Noah, welcome back to Central Time.
It is really good to be here. It's been a while, Veronica.
So you've got a new feature coming out, an ambitious feature that sounds like it's going to take the better part of a year. It's called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Why tackle this right now?
Right. So we wanted to, as a news department, to take on a year-long project. And you know, there are few things I would argue that are more important than food and water. They sustain life at the most elemental level and also our economy. And so we'll be taking a hard look at water, food, and land use here in Wisconsin. There are challenges. There are also countless opportunities that go along with this. You know, as we've talked about on WPR before, the food business brings in a lot of money in our local economies. So we'll be taking a look at this throughout the year with features on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Central Time, Joy Cardine Show, and of course on our website.
And it's called State of Change, which of course suggests that things are in flux. Where do you see some of the flashpoints that you're going to look at?
Yeah, so you know, one of the first things we're looking at in this series is Hope's story, Hope Kerwin's story on the average age of farmers here in Wisconsin, which is 57 years old. And that's pretty old if you look at an average, and that has a real impact on farms, individual farms, but also our rural economies. There are a lot of people retiring, but not as many people going into the profession. So what does that mean for our local economies? What does that mean for our food? And so we're looking at, you know, the ways that this industry is changing.
And that was the piece we just heard, your inaugural piece. Why start the series there, looking at the age of farmers?
Yeah, because there's a lot going on there. It talks about – it's about sort of the changing economies of farming, you know, from a size standpoint. We wanted to talk about what does farm succession look like? You know, what are some of the challenges that farmers are facing now passing their land on to either family members or people who want to lease their land? We're finding now that, you know, farmers, you know, look at their land in some cases as their retirement fund. What does that mean for them as far as when they can retire, if they can retire? Is it enough money for them to retire on? So we thought it was a really good way to introduce this idea of change and what impact that's having on the state.
Are there particular political trends, perhaps unfinished, that you'll be looking at that can play into this big picture?
Yeah, I mean, political trends for sure. I think we'll be talking about climate change, obviously, which is an environmental issue, but also political. But we will be talking about climate change and what effect that's having and going to have in the future on our crops and on our local economies here in Wisconsin. We'll be probing sort of the, I guess I'll call it, the tension between farmland and development. And we'll be probing that a little bit, you know, the pressure put on farmland, especially around urban areas. You know, what's lost, what's gained when farmland goes into development or vice versa. Maybe there's development and maybe there's an effort to bring back some of that farmland. So we're going to be looking at that. One of the other things that I and the team are particularly interested in is looking at our agricultural economy here in the state in an international perspective. So we think a lot about farming as a very local thing. It's something that a family does or maybe a small business. But these are businesses and people that are affected by trends that are happening around the world. And so we're interested in exploring, like, what happens if there is a drought in New Zealand? What does that mean for dairy prices? If there's a virus in cattle or something in Britain, what does that mean for meat prices here in Wisconsin? You know, what does the international cranberry market look like? These are all forces that help determine whether or not our farms are profitable or whether or not they end the year in the red. And in many cases, these are things that are sort of outside of our control, but sort of contribute to the success or not success of a farm. So we're interested in really connecting the dots for people between what's happening here in Wisconsin and what's happening around the world, because, of course, we are in a global economy.
Now, if you look at where the various agriculture industries are centered in Wisconsin, you've got wild rice, you've got cranberries in northern Wisconsin, dairy everywhere. Is this a chance, do you think, for the news department to really get out of the studio and connect with
all of these different areas of the state that maybe we don't hear about every single day.
Right, absolutely. I mean, we're going to leverage the statewide presence that we have in Wisconsin. We have bureaus in all the sort of major cities around the state, and we're going to leverage that geographical reach, and we're going to go into communities and explore this issue with farmers and business people. And really, yeah, as you say, leave the studio. And I think one of the things we really want to do is – yeah, we'll talk to experts, you know, but we're also keenly interested in talking to the people who this directly affects. And so throughout the year, you'll be hearing a lot of voices from people from a lot of different communities throughout the state.
And we just heard from Hope Kerwin, her piece on the age of farmers. What's next?
Right. So the next story we're going to hear in this series, Glenn Moberg produced it. And actually, it's an interesting one. It's featuring Jerry Apps, who we know in Wisconsin very well. The author just is out with a new book that sort of explores the relationship between farmers and rain. And it sort of harkens back to his childhood and his relationship with water. And so it's an opportunity for us to explore that connection between water and agriculture and farmers. And sometimes it's a great relationship, and sometimes it's a tense one. Sometimes it creates tension between neighbors, people who have access to water and electricity and people who don't. And so this next story is an opportunity to sort of explore that relationship between rain, water, and farming.
Sounds fantastic, Noah. We're looking forward to it. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That was Noah Shinsky, WPR's news director, joining us to talk about a new year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. You can find the stories online at WPR.org/change. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the Founding Fathers felt strongly that the only way for America to survive and succeed was as a united country. We look at whether we can return to that ideal given the current polarized state of the nation. First, there's more than one way to look at a landscape, from the hills of Appalachia to the structure of an English garden. Our guest legal scholar looks at the natural world around us through the lenses of history, law, and shared meaning. Jedediah Purdy joins us now. He's a law professor at Duke University, regular contributor to The New Yorker magazine, and the author of After Nature and the Meaning of Property, Freedom, Community, and the Legal Imagination. Jedediah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much.
Well, you spent a lot of time figuring out how to read a landscape. So can you lay out that question for us first? What does it mean to read a landscape?
Yeah, of course. So the places where we grow up or where we find ourselves, we tend to think of as if they were natural because, of course, it's just the world. Certainly how I felt about the landscape that I grew up in and the one that I moved to as an adult and live in now, which is the central part of North Carolina. So as I began a project on the history of American environmental law going all the way back to the founding era and coming forward, I came to realize that all of the iconic American landscapes, the checkerboard of the Midwest, the national parks like Yosemite and Glacier, the national forests, and less famous but really kind of important and telling ones like the Appalachian landscape of central West Virginia, where I grew up, are all very deeply shaped by a history of lawmaking that in turn has shaped the way that people have lived on that land and informed the kind of what they've made of it, the places that they have turned it into. And in turn, each of those ways of shaping a landscape through the legal formation of how people inhabit it has had behind it a way of seeing, really a way of thinking about why the natural world matters and how people fit into it and what we have at stake in trying to get right by it.
We think of, I think, natural agents causing changes to the land. You know, some man-made changes if you look at something like mining, but not so much the law. How does the law shape a landscape?
Well, if we think about the Midwestern landscape, for example, the checkerboard of private property that exists out there and that people like me who live in the East often see only from airplanes, but that if you live there, you might see most vividly when you're flying over it. was formed out of a whole series of federal statutes throughout the 19th century, the major body of American law dedicated to regulating the human relation to the natural world, was a giant legal machine for producing private property, for turning the frontier, which of course was being actively depopulated of Native Americans, into settled and productive agricultural land. So there wasn't only the famous Homestead Act, whereby you could get land through a combination of settling it and working it and purchasing it, but just any number of bargains that the law offered you to turn open land into private property by transforming it in a way that would be economically productive. You could drain swampland, you could irrigate dry land, you could plant trees on grassland, you could cut trees in forest, you could dig valuable minerals, you could gather stone. There was practically nothing you couldn't do that anyone would bother to do to make your mark on the land that wouldn't turn it into property. So the way we got that deeply settled, deeply worked terrain that you're calling me from was really a century-long national project that took its shape through a kind of legal mobilization of several generations of frontiers people.
I guess I think of landscapes as being the subject of the forces of nature again, and that eventually nature wins out, that we try to make fundamental changes, but you build, you know, a settlement on a swamp and the water comes back and reclaims it. Is that still true, or are we making indelible marks with the law and the choices we make?
No, it's such a wonderful question. So as you may know, geologists right now actually are debating the question of whether they should announce that the planet has entered a new geological era. Geologists conventionally say that we're living in about the 12,000th year of the Holocene, which is a period of relatively warm and stable global climates. And the proposal that they are debating is whether we should say that we now live in something they call the Anthropocene, which is a made-up word to mean the age of humanity. And their thought is that now, in a way that's never been true before, human activity is a geological force, that it may be the dominant force in shaping the future of the planet, and this is true from the chemistry of the atmosphere that drives climate change, to the acidification of the seas, to mass extinctions, to really profound changes on the level of landscape and terrain. If I think of what, to take a very concrete example, of what mountaintop removal strip mining has done in the region I come from, it's literally changed the dominant gradient of the land from a fairly steep 28-degree pitch, which is about the angle of the upper cables of the Brooklyn Bridge or other similar bridges, to a 2-degree line, which is to say slightly sloping flat ground. It's made a kind of uneven plateau out of what was for millions of years one of the most rugged regions of the country. So that's a change that's not going to go away for hundreds of millions of years. And the transformation of the whole planet's geological system is built out of hundreds of transformations of that kind, which even if nature, so to speak, takes them back, will never be what they were before. There will be something else which people have helped to make.
So as someone who studies all these aspects and all these layering mechanisms of what you see when you look at the land, does it change what you see and your idea, I guess, of what nature, you know, maybe in quotes, what nature is?
A Wisconsinite, you will know, Aldo Leopold, famously said that one of the penalties of an ecological education was living alone in a world of wounds. He meant that you could see, if you knew what had been there before, you could see all the harm, and you would go around feeling the pain of it. I think as more and more of us appreciate that we're living in a world that we can't help making and that we've changed indelibly from what it was before, that we'll be able both to recognize the wounds and also to find ways of being more deliberate and self-aware about the kinds of changes that we're making, so that we can think about not just why we prize Glacier National Park, say, but what kind of farmland we might want people to be able to live on and work 200 years from now, and what kinds of lives we might want that landscape to make possible for them. So I guess that's a way of saying that there's a great sadness in trying to absorb the harm that we're doing. But part of the sadness in Leopold's great observation had to do with being alone in a world of wounds, being part of a small minority that could see it. And as more and more people see it and we can think about what it is we want to make, there might be the beginning of some kind of hope in that.
Now, to take us back to the beginning as we wrap up, I know you think about our landscape of origin, where we're born, and how we're, in a sense, we're native to that landscape. So what does that landscape that we inherit when we're born mean to us?
I'll just say that I think this is something that the whole country and in some ways much of the world are fighting about right now or wrestling with right now. It's an amazing fact about words that nature comes from the Latin root that it shares with native and nation, and all of those have to do with the root sense of birth, of the place that you emerge from, and also with the sort of power of nature to keep renewing itself, the sort of living dimension of the natural world. And right now, of course, these ideas, the importance of where you come from, are expressing themselves in political doctrines.
And we leave it there. Jedediah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Jedediah Purdy, law professor at Duke University and the author of The Meaning of Property, Freedom, Community, and the Legal Imagination. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's Reveal. President Donald Trump wants to build a wall between America and Mexico. Hundreds of miles of border fence are already in place, but most of the nearly 2,000-mile stretch is uncovered. On this episode of Reveal, the political, logistical, and geographic barriers that could get in the way of the president's plans. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, while our country may be called the United States of America, these days it can feel like anything but. Tensions are still running high after one of the most divisive elections in the history of the country. But our next guest says there's a way forward, and it requires looking to the past. In a new book, she says that we as Americans need to re-embrace the vision our country's founders once had, the belief that we could stand as a great nation only if we stood united, and by re-embracing some of the core values they had, we can all become better citizens and demand the best from those who represent us. Sophia Nelson joins us now. She's an award-winning author and journalist and has previously served as a congressional committee counsel in the House of Representatives. Her new book is called E Pluribus One, Reclaiming Our Founders' Vision for a United America. Sophia, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start off by asking you, how would you describe the state of our union right now?
Oh, that is a great question. Loaded question, but it's a great question. You know, look, I think that we have had challenging times before as a country, and we are in the midst of one of those times. I think that whenever any great society, as we are, has demographic shifts, we're seeing it in Europe, right, with the Brexit vote, and we saw it here in America in the 2016 election. There's a bit of nationalism going on, and that always happens when we have great shifts in our demographics, meaning we have more people of color now in the United States. We have more influx of immigrants, whether legal or illegal immigrants. We have diverse religious backgrounds. We have a lot of diversity, which has always been our great strength. But what happens is that when the heartland, when what you would call your everyday hard-working American people, whether they're black, white, whoever they are, there's this sense of nostalgia. My country's not the way it used to be. Things aren't the way that I grew up with them. And what happens is we're resistant to change, right? We're resistant to growth. We're resistant to transformation. This is very common. It's happened in civilization since the beginning of time. And America is really in the middle of what I call a midlife crisis. That's really what's happening with us. And so that's why you see so much division, if you will. That's why you see so much rancor and fighting and polarization, because people are trying to wrestle with who are we as the United States of America. And I would argue we're who we've always been, which is our founding fathers coined the phrase, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. They understood in 1778, 1780, which is when the seal got adopted, that oneness was always going to come from our great diversity. So I would say we're doing okay. We're just having a bit of a midlife crisis right now.
It's comforting that you think it's cyclical, which implies that things will get better before, you know, maybe a couple hundred years they get worse again. So what is it going to take to get into the upswing of that cycle?
Well, you know, you said something I think key, which is that, you know, if you look at the world's great republics, you know, I like to make this point. America is a republic. It is not a democracy, and they're very different. It's a democratic republic or a constitutional republic, if you want to call it such. And that means that direct government is in the hands of the people through their elected representatives, which come from our neighbors, our friends, et cetera. And so I think that the question is, how long do republics stand? Well, Rome is the last great republic, and we know that republics last about 300 years, right? That's, if we're looking at history, that's about where they stand. We're at 241, right? Which means we're on a ticking clock. And the question becomes, can we right this ship of state here and hearken to the values that the founders gave us, which I believe are timeless? I believe that they gave us a brilliant roadmap to where we were going and to where this country needed to always be in order to thrive and be the great country that it is. And I think that what we have to decide right now, and I think we're in the process of deciding that, right, are we going to be, to borrow a phrase, a divided states of America, where we've got blue-collar workers over in this pocket, we've got Southerners who, you know, favor gun rights over in this pocket, we've got the urban enterprise centers over in this corner, and then we've got progressives up in the New England and out in the far west corners. If that's who we're going to be, we're probably going to have a challenge, because at some point, I think what the founders understood was that when they coined the phrase e pluribus unum, out of many, one, what I want people to understand is that didn't mean our founders didn't disagree. It didn't mean that they didn't not get along at times. In fact, Virginia had very little in common with Boston, right? And if you know your history about how the Great Revolutionary War started here in America, Boston started to have the problems first, right, with the crown. And the other colonies came kicking and screaming. Right? They were like, hey, Boston, that's great, but that's your problem up there. You're having a problem with the crown. Those of us down here in South Carolina, we're thriving. We have slave labor. We've got cotton. We've got rice. We're rich. We're not having a problem with the crown. So why would we go to war for independence, and why would we unify? Well, ultimately, they unified because they understood that if they had any shot of being a nation, they were going to have to come together despite their differences. And that's what I hope my countrymen can see right now, that some of what we're doing is very destructive to the republic.
We're talking with Sophia Nelson right now. She is the author of E Pluribus One, Reclaiming Our Founders' Vision for United America. And when we look back, we have to remember that not everyone was on the same page even then. Mm-hmm. You said we came together, but for instance, you write about this in your book, how do you reconcile the vision of the founders with their actions, namely the fact that many of them owned slaves at the time?
Absolutely. And don't forget, women were oppressed. Women were chattel. Women couldn't vote. Women had no rights here either. And I think the way you reconcile it is the way that you reconcile any history, and that is that you have to keep things in their context. And I think where we get in trouble is when we want to look at the founding fathers through a 21st century lens. You can't, right? Because they weren't living in the 21st century. They were living at a time where slavery was literally being practiced by every civilized, quote-unquote, great nation on earth, whether it was Spain, England, France, etc., the United States. It was being practiced everywhere. Does that make it right? Absolutely nice. Wrong. Does it make it okay? No, it doesn't. What it makes it is what it was. And what I say to people is, here's the greatness, though, of what the founding fathers did. When Thomas Jefferson, who was a slave owner, and from all accounts that we all can know at this point in history, had a 30, 40-year relationship with one of his young female slaves, who was actually his wife's half-sister, right? This man wrote the words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," right? "Endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights." Let's stop there for a moment. Now, when Thomas Jefferson writes those words, he's a slave owner and having an affair with his young slave, which there's a power structure inequity because she can't tell him no. It's not like she can not join in and not participate. She didn't have that kind of power over her own body. And so you're right, there is this extreme disconnect with these great men who had this great vision of liberty for themselves. But when they wrote the words, and if you look at the legislative record, if you were to look at, you know, the debates and everything that they were having at the time, what you would see is that there was a lot of discussion about these very issues of slavery, et cetera. And you remember Abigail Adams saying to her husband, John, "Remember the ladies," right? She was telling him that you can't build a new nation without including us, too. We need rights, too. We need to be participants as well. And certainly that fell on deaf ears for a long time. But the greatness of the words that Thomas Jefferson penned and the greatness of America is the vision and the constant perfecting of our union. And so the union constantly gets better. It constantly is perfected by the men and women who are provocateurs, who are disruptors, people from Paul Revere to Elizabeth Cady Stanton to Madam C.J. Walker to Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, and Abraham Lincoln, people who push us to live up to the calling of our founding fathers. And that's why I said we need to reclaim their vision, because the vision was perfect. It was pretty bad the way they went about implementing it at the time, with slavery and women being denied rights and being considered property of their husbands. But ultimately, we righted that. And we end up in the 21st century with our first African-American president.
We're talking right now with political commentator Sophia Nelson. She's the author of the new book, E Pluribus One, and she's making the case that we as Americans need to rediscover the things that unite us, not that divide us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think we can become a more united country? And going one step further, how do you think we can become better citizens? Do you think it's important to look to the past to understand the present and what's expected of us? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with political commentator Sophia Nelson. She's the author of the new book, E Pluribus One, and wants us as American citizens to reclaim our founders' vision for a united and strong America to overcome the divisiveness of today. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think there's more that unites us than divides us. And what should we be rallying around? How can we be more engaged, well-informed, and empathetic citizens? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Take a first caller now. We've got Zach on the line in Ashland. Zach, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I heard the question, and I thought it was a great question. I think there's more that brings us together than that divides us. And don't get me wrong, there is a lot going on that distracts us. However, we're going through these changes together as a country. We have to accept Barack Obama as the first president, first African-American president, and we all have to accept Donald Trump, and he's doing a great job personally. And the main thing is that all these changes are happening, and as Americans, we are accepting these changes and moving forward and changing along with it as a country. So I think there's more that does unite us than that does divide us.
Zach, thank you so much for that call. And Zach says, yes, there is more that brings us together than that divides us. He sees us changing together. How important is it, Sophia, to, as we go through some of these things, these, for example, demographic shifts that you're talking about, how important is it that we change together?
Well, I don't think we're doing a lot of changing together at the moment. I think we're trying to, like I said, it's a midlife crisis. And what happens in a midlife crisis? You get a fast car, you get a girlfriend that's 25 years younger, right? You go do crazy things because you've lost your compass. You don't know who you are, and you're trying to figure out, you know, where you're going and what you're doing. And I think what America has done, particularly in this last election, I mean, look, I think we do accept that Barack Obama was the first black president, and Donald Trump is the president of the United States right now, and people may not like it, they may not agree with it, they may want to protest it. That's the beauty of America. That's their right. But the fact of the matter is he is the president of this country, and there are a lot of Americans who don't feel like he's doing a good job, right? There was a women's march that was exceptional all around the globe, in point of fact. I mean, you have the British Parliament voting that they don't want him to come for a state visit. It's like it's madness in ways that I've never really seen before, which says to me that people are not in sync, they're not in step, and they're not together. And what I'm suggesting is that America has always been a country where we disagree, we dissent, we protest, we provoke, we provoke, we do all those things because that's what keeps liberty refreshed, as Thomas Jefferson would say. And so I'm not worried about that. What I am concerned about is that we respect our institutions. So we don't undermine judges when they're on the bench and they've been confirmed by the Senate by calling them so-called judges. We don't pick on a free press and pick which members of the press are allowed access and lock others out. And when we get personally offended by members of the press corps, we bar their media outlets from access. That's not what we do here in America. We have a free press. We have a judiciary that has the same power as the executive and the legislative branches of government. And so it's very, very important that we remember that we're different and we're unique, and that's what makes us the greatest nation on the face of this earth.
Thanks a lot for the call, Zach. And we move next to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, just a comment on your last response. A free press doesn't have a reporter giving debate questions to one of the candidates as opposed to the other. So I don't know if we really have a free press or an unbiased press right now. But my real question was one based on the Constitution. If we are hearkening back to the old times, do we go with the Constitution that was originally written as Scalia does, as the original intent of the writers, or do we view it as a living, breathing document that allows us to change with the times? Thanks so much.
Charlie, thank you for that. And a couple parts of Charlie's question, Sophia, but one is getting at, to me, what happens if people stop believing in the institutions that our nation is founded on, in a sense, like the press. There may be other instances as well. And also, what about the Constitution? Do we are we an originalist, or do we think that it's breathing and it can be changed?
Well, great questions, and they're addressed in the book. I'll take this issue of whether you're a strict constructionist, a textualist, or if you're a living, breathing person. So you would look at the Earl Warren Court, for example, is to me, and it's in the book, the Warren Court, I talk about the expansion of rights that happens in the 1860s with the Radical Republican Congress, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, which abolished slavery, instituted equal protections under the law, and gave black men the right to vote, 15th Amendment. Women and black women did not have the right to vote yet. And so that's one period, and then you go forward to the Warren Court era, which is in the 1950s, Brown versus the Board of Education, and a series of cases that lead us all the way up to the Civil Rights era. And I would suggest that the Constitution is and has always been a living, breathing document. Now, people want to argue that, but let me just take this from a very personal point. If the Constitution is not a living, breathing document, Sophia Nelson is still a slave. She's a black woman, so she doesn't have a whole lot going for her in America if we're going to hearken to the original intent and the laws. I'm three-fifths of a person. I'm not even a whole human being. You as a woman don't have any rights. You're the property of your husband. You can't vote. You can't even get your children in custody in a divorce. We could go on and on and on. You don't have the right to contract. You don't have the right to own anything, and so thank God the Constitution expands and breathes, which gets back to my point about this notion of perfecting the Union. The vision as set forth in the Constitution has everything to do with liberty and everything to do with freedom, right? It has to do with our rights coming from our Creator God. This is what our founders believe. No man is above another man, yet they own slaves. So you see these contradictions because they're men. And men, for mankind, flawed. We're all flawed. I'm flawed. You're flawed. We all have issues. We all have failings. So, as I said, you have to view the founders in the context of the time in which they existed, which is the 17th and 18th century, right? You have to look at them as men of their time. Doesn't excuse them, but it explains and gives you a window into their world. But the vision that they wrote is beautiful. The words, again, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. What a powerful statement, right? It sounds great on paper, but it took us 100 years or more before those words could actually apply to men of color, to women of color, and to white women, right? Because in the original document, it didn't apply to those groups of people. Is everybody following me? Hopefully that makes sense. So for people who say, I'm going to be a strict constructionist, well, I think it depends. If you're looking at the Second Amendment, Sophia Nelson would probably be a strict constructionist. I believe that the Second Amendment, which deals with the right to keep and bear arms, is pretty clear cut. I think that our liberty has everything to do with the fact that Americans were able to own guns. Had they not been able to own guns in the 1700s, when Great Britain decided they were going to taxation without representation, they were going to have mob rule, and they were going to start to abuse the colonists the way they did starting in Boston, had they not had muskets and been able to fight back, you and I would be saluting Queen Elizabeth. She would have her picture on the wall instead of Donald J. Trump.
Sophia, I want to ask you, we're getting close to the end of our time together here. It's about a minute left, but you call on us as citizens to get active and to change and do things and not put it off on politicians, but to hold the power ourselves as citizens. In our last, less than a minute, what would you like us to do? What's at the top of the list?
Engage, informed, and self-governing. That is code number one in the book. That is the call of the founding fathers, to be engaged, to be informed, and to always be self-governing. Self-governing means we're a republic. We pick representatives to represent us in Washington, and when they don't do the job, we throw them out. If a president's not right, we can impeach them. We do have the right of a free press. We do have the right to keep and bear arms. We do have free speech. They gave us every tool for us to be vigilant and to keep watch. We have this backwards. We think that the government is our boss. We're their boss. So we need to reclaim the founders' vision for how this country is supposed to run, and it's supposed to run by we the people. And that's really how we take control of things that are going on right now. We have to reclaim that mantle, and the power rests with us.
Sophia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sophia Nelson, author, journalist, and political commentator. Her new book is called A Pluribus One, Reclaiming Our Founders' Vision for a United America. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.